Environmentalist Aldo Leopold once said, "A first step in developing an ecological conscience is to recognize we are but plain members and citizens in community, not conquerors." Frederick Kirschenmann, farmer philosopher, took this to heart and has let himself be led into a life where he is a headliner and leader in all things sustainable. His book, Cultivating an Ecological Conscience, reflects in essay form his own ever-growing awareness, which translates into some very astute knowledge when it comes to cooperating with and partnering with nature. I'm Robin Clare. Do stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Fred, it sure seems that you've got some basics covered being a farmer and a religion and philosophy professor.
I always tell people that I've never planned anything I've done in my life. It's always responding to things that come up. So it's been a fascinating journey for me, and I'm at a point now where I not only still have some strong connections with my farm in North Dakota, and I'm involved here at the Leopold Center at Iowa State University, which is in the heart of commodity agriculture. And then also now I'm involved with the Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture, located just outside of New York City, where I am engaged with especially some young farmers who are interested in the emerging urban agriculture. So what could be more fascinating than all of that?
I would agree. It's a great, great multifaceted direction to be in. I've heard you quote Wendell Berry with, "A hard-headed realist uses a lot less information than is available." And this just led me in a lot of different directions, because it appears that environmentalists so often get lost in their concern for the earth, becoming almost Gestapo-esque in their methodologies or their mentality.
I think that one of the things that's been a part of our culture going back to the 17th century, which is that we thought about everything in terms of isolated phenomenon and so isolated disciplines, and our educational system still pretty much follow that paradigm. There's very little conversation that takes place among disciplines and trying to look at whole systems. I think that the environmental movement is no more at fault around that than much of the rest of the way in which we address our problems and our opportunities. So we tend to operate out inside of our own little worlds rather than trying to learn from the different ways that people look at things.
Farmers basically figure out how to do anything just because they have to. And so you've said that all problems are evolutionary in character and require a systems approach rather than a one-dimensional approach. And,
right.
And that's certainly true for farming, but it's certainly for everything. I mean, that statement that I just quoted from you could be the beginning of a self-help book on any subject. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that in a sense, going beyond the farm or the actual dirt sustainability.
Yeah. Well, again, this is a long cultural problem that I think we have in our society, where Rene Descartes, Francis Bacon, and others really saw the world as a collection of separate objects, that could be manipulated for the benefit of the human species. Rene Descartes once said that we had to become the masters and possessors of nature. And Francis Bacon that we needed to bend nature to our will. So there was this assumption that we could take pieces of nature and force them to do what we wanted them to do. And of course, certainly since the 19th century, we have come to realize that nature is not a collection of objects. It's a communion of subjects in which everything within nature affects everything else in nature. And we have, even until quite recently, in my view, pretty much ignored the role that microbes play.
That's where I was going.
They're pretty essential. Even in terms of soil science, it's only been recently that soil scientists have started to talk about the microbiome in soil. And soil scientists, even as recently as 20 years ago, used to talk about soil as a material to hold a plant in place. It was like assuming it was just dirt to be the medium that, you know, held the roots in place. But fortunately, you know, you don't see that anymore. And now there are increasingly soil scientists who are talking about soil health and the role that the microbes in soil play in that. And as near as I can tell, soil scientists haven't even come to an agreement as to how many microbes are in the soil. There's one soil scientist, for example, that estimated there were probably 500 million microorganisms in a teaspoonful of soil. And at least one soil scientist has seen thought there was as many as 4 billion. But whatever the number is, soil is this vibrant, living community. And so we can't just treat soil however we want to in order to achieve our objectives, you know, put anything into it we want to increase our yields, et cetera. We have to look at the impact of all of those living in a relationship. It's like going into a human community and deciding that we can, do 6 or 7 things within the human community, and it will only affect, you know, what we want it to affect, rather than recognizing that, you know, the humans react to that in different ways, and we come up with probably a very different kind of social phenomenon than we thought we were going to get by the actions that we took. And so we have to begin to think about the entire living ecology as a dynamic, interacting, living group of organisms. Although Leopold once famously said that we had to stop treating the land as if it was a commodity belonging to us and more a community to which we belong. And by land, he meant, of course, the whole biotic community, everything from soil microbes to mammals.
Yes, definitely. And when you're talking about Descartes, it almost seemed okay the way he talked about it, but with the things that we've been able to do to manipulate the world and the earth, with everything from chemicals for the land to crazy weapons, it's too scary now to come from that vantage point.
Yeah. And for a long time, we were able to ignore the unintended consequences, the externalities, environmental externalities, social externalities, that we figured we could just get out of the way and we could still do what we wanted to do. But, you know, as we all know, many of those externalities are now, coming home to roost. And so we're going to have to start paying attention to them.
Yes. Well, with such a focus on restoring, repairing, and healing and feeding the world, it's kind of tough not to slide into a managing frame of mind. And yet this approach gets in its own way pretty quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, that brings another issue up. I mean, and again, we've created these cultures. And, Paul Roberts published a book recently now called The Impulse Society. And he makes the clearest case that I've ever seen, a description that I've ever seen, that we now live in a society in which everything is about mine and now. And so we all operate in terms of what we can get for ourselves right now, regardless. And we don't want to think about any impact that's going to have for the future, for the most part. And he makes a very compelling case that this is a culture that we have to modify and overcome, so that we recognize that things aren't just about mine and now; they're about the communities that we live in and the impact that our activities will have into the future. Otherwise, we're going to be in, and especially our children and grandchildren are going to be in serious trouble.
Yes. Well, with this focus on needing to make things right, and whether we blame ourselves or not, how do you see a shift possible, or what do you see in the shift that is, I'm sure, happening, getting away from that management into more of a community cooperative?
Yeah, that's a really probably one of the most important questions we have to deal with. And one of the things, I always do try to look for some little good news here and there. And one of the things that I found inspiring was Marjorie Kelly's more recent book called Owning Our Future. And she points out that we actually have in our society now two different kinds of economies. One's what she calls the extractive economy, which is similar to what Paul Roberts talks about mine and now. We want to extract the wealth out of our communities for ourselves, to enrich ourselves. And that's the sole thing that drives us. And she points out that economy is now reaching a point where it's going to become increasingly dysfunctional, and that there are already some examples of the alternative economy, which he calls the generative economy, where people in communities, and by communities I don't necessarily mean whole cities, but sometimes they're simply groups of people within a region or within a space where they begin to cooperate together as communities to enrich the common flourishing of life, as she puts it, and that those are much more satisfying for the communities and for the individuals in those communities than those that still live in the culture of an extractive economy. So we'll have to see how all of that plays out, but I do think that one of the things, too, and I don't want to over-romanticize this, but especially because I have the opportunity at the Stone Barn Center now to work with an incredible number of the next generation of farmers, young people, most of whom never even grew up on a farm, but they want to farm now. And they want to farm because they don't want to raise commodity crops. They want to raise food for people, and they want that relationship with people. And I could name a number of couples who are young couples who most of them have a couple of children. They would no more think of taking their children to a shopping mall for an inspiring experience. They take them out to the garden. And then you see these children getting excited about learning how to grow food and being able to, be a part of the family and making that food available. And there's a deep level of satisfaction, not only in the children, but also in the parents, because they have that, that sense of community and relationship to not only to other young farmers in the community, but also that relationship to nature. And that's very inspiring to see. I don't know what the percentage of population of these new millennials now are moving in that direction, but I run into quite a few of them, and it's very inspiring.
Right. Well, it's almost like the number of microbes you were just talking about. We don't know if there's, 1,000 or millions, and it's like we don't have to necessarily know that. It's the fact that it's happening. Yeah. And I heard an author talk about the jumping Jesus phenomena one time, and it was, in the first 5 years of man having flights and going around the world on airplanes, that was one number. And then in another 5 years, it was just hugely magnified number. And I think that's the way things go. And it's interesting that when a system gets too top heavy, it leads back to that community, to the cooperative in such a, it's like a fail-safe system, even though it seems very dire, which of course it is. But
Well, and that direness is, it's very easy to, when you see, some of the kinds of domination and concentration of power and, that we see in our culture every day, and it's very easy to get, pretty discouraged about the possibilities of any changes. But one of the stories I like to tell is out of my own experience when I took my first American history course when I was a sophomore in high school. And the first day of class, our teacher got up in front of the class, and he was a young guy, probably couldn't have been more than 25 or 30 years old. And he got up in front of the class and he said, "I want you all to know that only 20% of the American colonists were in favor of the American Revolution. And the reason I want you to know that is because the reason that you study history is to learn from the past about how things can apply, for your own world and what you can accomplish." And so he said, if you want to bring about some changes, the important thing to remember about that lesson from history is you don't need 100% to bring about change. Just 20% will do it.
I love that. That's such a rare thing to hear in a history class.
Yeah.
I've heard that about getting meditation groups together. They did a study in D.C. one time about lowering crime rates, and they felt that this group of meditators were able to accomplish that. And But I like that about the revolution, because we sure need to know that now, all of us.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And which really brings us into, I love your use of the word dwell. You use the word dwell to really be somewhere. You know, when you were you were talking about how you have farmers that are on boards to talk about systems and renewal and change, and then you have the corporate types who have their ideas, but they have no experience.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the things that I think, again, one of the other encouraging things is that we've had some people of wisdom from the past that have understood, you know, some of these issues. And one of my heroes from the past is Aldo Leopold, as I, you know, implied a little bit earlier. But, he began to recognize early on, primarily in terms of his engagement in and involvement with nature and how nature functioned, and he recognized that if we were going to be successful in our life on Earth, that we had to learn to dwell in it, and as he put it at one point, he said that we are not the conquerors of, again, what he called the land community, by which he meant the entire biotic community. We're not the conquerors of the biotic community. We're simply plain members and citizens, and so there, for that reason, we have to learn to dwell in nature, to become connected, not just be, observers, detached from. And again, I think in terms of, one of my, you know, passions is to try to encourage more and more people, you know, to dwell in soil. You know, the soil isn't just dirt. Soil is this living community. And restoring the biological health of soil is going to be critical to solving many of the challenges we're going to be facing in the future, because especially when you look in terms of the issue of our food and agriculture system, we have now essentially depleted most of the synthetic resources that we have been depending on to maintain the yields of resources like rock phosphate. There are only four countries that still have rock phosphate reserves, only four countries that still have potash reserves. And Ugo Bardi, who published a book recently called Extracted, which has now become another Club of Rome report, and he goes into great detail about how we've extracted so many of these natural resources that we've been dependent on in our whole industrial economy, and that they're just not going to be there for us in the future. But you also look at things like water, you know, because we haven't paid attention to the biological health of soil, our soils no longer absorb moisture like it has a capacity to, like healthy soil has a capacity to. And so we've now become extremely dependent on irrigation for the moisture to raise, you know, our crops and vegetables, et cetera. And so we now use 70% of our freshwater resources on the planet just for agricultural irrigation. And we're drawing down our freshwater resources all across the planet. And then you add to that the likely impact of climate change with more floods and more droughts. So during flooding times, when you have too much rainfall without healthy soil, most of the water runs off the surface. Most of our soils now only absorb a half inch of rainwater an hour, then it starts to run off. And then that adds, of course, to the quality of the water. And then during drought periods, of course, there's no moisture there, so then we have to have enormous amounts of irrigation to keep irrigating our soils in order to sustain, you know, the crops that we want to grow. And what we've discovered now, as in here's again part of the good news that we look at, is that when one of the things that farmers now are starting to do, even in the commodity world, is to plant cover crops. Because when you plant cover crops, instead of simply a corn soybean rotation, you only have those two crops growing. And then if you add a mixture of cover crops into that, and so that you then have green crops growing in your field, depending on where you are, it's 7, 8, sometimes 9, 10 months out of the year instead of 2 or 3 months, and those cover crops begin to restore the biological health of soil. And farmers who have used cover crops now, incorporated cover crops for a period of 7 or 8 years, they have discovered now that they can reduce their fertilizer and pesticide input by 70%, still maintain their yields, and the quality of the soil improves to a point where instead of only absorbing a half inch of rainwater an hour, it now absorbs 8 inches of rainwater an hour.
Reading that.
We need to begin to engage soil, to dwell in the soil, and realize, the role which it has to play in sustaining our lives as humans in the future.
Yes, absolutely. Well, this really leads into a question. I believe our audience is very well educated, really, in principles of sustainability, and I would say most are not farmers. And knowing this, is there more that you want to share that you feel, as an Earth citizen, we need to know?
Well, I think that, and here again, it's one of the things that I'm learning at the Stone Barn Center. In addition to working with young farmers, we also work with children. We now have 10,000 children, come through the programs at the Stone Barn Center every year, and these are mostly children who come from urban communities. So when they first arrive there, and we have some arrangements with public school systems where they bring children out to the Stone Barns and spend a half a day and as part of their curriculum. And so, children who have no idea where food comes from other than they go to the supermarket to get it, suddenly they begin to realize where food comes from, and they learn how to grow it and how to prepare it. And, let me just give you one example as, the kind of transformation that takes place. We always, of course, our staff first meet these children and then engage them. And one of our staff, and there's a number of fantastic stories, but I can't tell you all of them, but my favorite one is a school bus came out with some 8 and 9-year-old children. And so our staff member took them out to the gardens to show them, where the food was grown. And at one point she reached down and pulled a carrot out of the ground and then washed it off and then handed it to the kids so they could each have a bite to see how great the carrots tasted, because in really healthy soil, one of the other benefits is you get great tasting food. And so she said the one little 8-year-old boy walked right up to her, looked her in the eye and said, "Oh, gross, who stuck those in the dirt? Now we can't eat them." And so, that's the start. And I don't mean that in any derogatory way.
No, of course not.
It's where they start. And then some of the feedback we're getting now is many of these children, after they have gone through the program, to learn where food comes from and how to grow it and how to prepare it, then they talk their parents into converting a part of their lawns into gardens so that they can grow food for the family. Oh. And someday I want to be able to get feedback when these children are, 20 or 25 years old, and find out what, as they look back, what impact that experience have in the way they have, what kind of quality of life they have now.
Yes, it just reminded me of programs I've heard about in prisons where they do a lot of this. But the crazy thing I've heard is that in California, for instance, the prisoners are not allowed to eat the food because all prisons in California have to have the same food.
Yeah, there we go with the rules again, right?
Right. Yeah. You know, Fred, your book, Cultivating an Ecological Conscience, is such a great read. And my dad has passed on. He was a farmer. He was an apple orchard guy. And I just wish I could give it to him as a present, because he would enjoy it so much. And you close it writing about how our survival as a species probably is not the result of always carefully thinking things out and obtaining definitive scientific proof before acting to escape life-threatening situations, but more likely because of timely gut reactions. And that's what all of nature just draws out from us, isn't it? Just being connected through the gut. And, you know, what's in our gut is all that microflora.
Yeah, exactly. And again, one of the things that that scientists are beginning to explore now is the impact on our guts of, you know, some of the kinds of foods that we're eating now. And, you know, that's you know, science is always a process, and it's going to take some time to really have that become a part of, you know, the public knowledge. But it's very clear that, again, you know, our guts are full of, you know, it's a microbiome. And so, you know, we're going to have a better understanding of the impact that not only is some of the food that we're eating has on our gut, but also, you know, how the air that we breathe, the water that we drink. I mean, again, one of the things, you know, there are correlations between some of the things that we're doing and some of the health issues that we're experiencing, health problems. But correlations are never indications of causations, but they are indications that we need to explore to see what is causing some of these things. So the increases in autism and increases in cancer rates, it's, you know, there's a whole range of things that that are problematic from a health perspective. And also at some point, and I'm not a healthcare professional, so I'm not an expert in this, but I'm fortunate to have some colleagues and friends who are. And they're pointing out to me that, you know, back in the 1950s, we were spending about 20% of our disposable income on food and something like 6 or 7%, as I recall, on health care. Mm-hmm. Now we're spending a little less than 10% on food and 18% on health care. And they're pointing out that regardless what we do with the health care system, and certainly it needs some of the kind of you know, modifications that the Affordable Care Act is trying to address. But they're pointing out that even with that, that if we don't begin to address the causes of our health problems, then they project by the year 2050 we'll be spending 25% of GDP on health care, and at that point the system just would not be functional.
Right. Well, I think we can look forward to the system rebuilding itself.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Fred Kirschenman's On to Something, Creating an Ecological Conscience, the title of his University Press of Kentucky book. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for our weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. We're podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.